What is up, everybody, and welcome back to the Primal King Podcast. This is episode number 117. All right, so today I have an awesome guest, crazy backstory. We literally could have sat here and done this for like, I don't even know. We could have talked for hours for sure. We didn't even get into half of the stuff that I wanted to chat with him, but maybe we'll do a round two one of these days soon. So I know you guys are going to love his story, where he came from, what he's doing now. It's just such a cool, inspiring, awesome story. Hopefully you'll all go out and get his book as well. We'll talk about that in the episode. So anyways, hopefully you guys really, really love this one. Also too, we're getting close to the holiday season, getting close to Christmas now. It's kind of last minute, right? If you're still not sure what to do, go to crossomeats.com, go in there, get yourself a gift card. You can give the gift of beef to anybody, especially, you know, we all have those people that it's like, I have no idea what to buy them. I don't even know what they like. You know, maybe you drew their name, like our family draws names, whatever. Hey, give them like an awesome Still Not Vegan shirt. That's a pretty, you know, pretty rare type of a shirt there. You could get them the gift of a gift card for me. You could buy them just a beef box, whatever, right? Go to crossomeats.com. Also, too, maybe you have something where it's like, hey, we got a really low limit on what you can spend for Christmas. Go to blackriflecoffee.com. Everyone loves coffee. So, also, too, like use the primal code, the promo code Primal King and get 20% off. Because if you're going to get coffee, maybe you want to get it for someone for Christmas, might as well save yourself a little bit of money. So, again, you go to blackriflecoffee.com, use the code Primal King, save yourself 20% off. Now, you got everybody covered. You can get them meat. You can get them coffee. I just opened up your Christmas shopping and made it so much easier. You can thank me later. All right, everybody, let's get started. So the question is this: how do we live the best life that we can with the limited amount of time that we get to be here? Is it by accumulating success and fame and fortune and everything else that society tells us that we need in order to be fulfilled? Or is it much more simple than that? My name is Derek Wilson. I'm the host of the Primal King Podcast, and we're going to be answering this as well as many other questions as we move forward. What is up, everybody, and welcome back to another episode of the Primal King Podcast. Super excited for my guest today, and he's in-house. All right, this is someone who is a descendant of Afghan nobles that was forced to flee their homeland in 1979. He assimilated in the U.S. through his love of sports, where he excelled in wrestling, football, and boxing. From there, the accomplishments are too many to lay out, but among them were becoming a six-time mixed martial arts world champion head coach, working with some of the biggest names in professional sports, like NFL stars Marshawn Lynch and Marcus Peters, helped to start sports programs in his war-torn native country of Afghanistan, and so much more. However, some of his most impactful missions has been spreading courage over fear. He is the author of the massively successful and insightful book, Empower, Conquering the Disease of Fear. It's changing the game for so many. I'm extremely grateful to welcome in Tariq Azim. Did I pronounce your name right?
Of course. Grand slam. Grand slam.
Awesome. Awesome. Well, again, it's so awesome to have you in studio too. So what a fascinating story, man. Like, first off, just researching you. I guess maybe the best place to start is from the beginning. Do you remember, like, kind of leaving the country, coming over here, or just what was that like, I guess?
Yeah, so my family actually fled Afghanistan, and in transition to trying to figure out what the next home is, the temporary home, they ended up in Germany, in Munich, where I was born.
Okay.
So it was a whole refugee establishment set up at some of the locals they'd assigned to all the refugees who had fled Afghanistan due to the Soviet invasion. So my parents and my older sister left Afghanistan in 79. In 82, we were still trying to figure out where our family is, where to go, like what's next. I was born. And during that period is where we started to get some news that, you know, family had made their ways to the United States, and the United States had a massive open arms policy to the refugees of Afghanistan. And, you know, during that period, you know, my family had a very, very, very hard time, leaving, you know, obviously what they had, who they were, how to live into this complete opposite life of, you know, you've got my mother, who is the daughter of the most decorated general in the history of Afghanistan, who created Bagram Air Force Base, who's the first commanding jet fighter and jet pilot in the history of Afghanistan. And then you've got my father, who is the son of Shal Pacha, the king of Kunar, and came from a massive, you know, entrepreneurial background, but also a very country-renowned spiritual leader who led a ton of battles and wars for the freedom of these very particular Pashtun regions with 0 ounce of blood, primarily the power of language and communication. So you had, you know, two parents who came from these figures and this standard and this ideology and this you know style of life to immediately peasantry.
Yeah.
Right. Living in a one bedroom, it was a one studio hotel with two kids in Germany, trying to figure out where your family is.
Wow.
Where's your mom? Where's your brothers? Where's your cousins? Like, how long are we here? When do we go back? And at that period in time is when we found out some of our family had made their way out to New York, to Queens, and also to San Francisco, and submitted the entire, you know, refugee process of for a green card and really going through this process that existed for individuals to get to the United States. And it took almost 4 years for us to be cleared to come to the U.S. So it started about a year and a half or two before I was born, and then 2 years after. And then we got our welcome invitation to San Francisco.
Wow.
And we finally reunited with our family after, you know, 4 or 5 years of being apart. Got to meet everybody for the first time, obviously. And at that point in period, it was when I would say the war began, of the war of belonging.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we grew up in a fantastic household, two amazing parents who weren't really parents, they're kind of your friends. And very positive, very strict at home, strict primarily on just protecting culture. And culture to us wasn't necessarily, hey, do this and be Afghan. It was do this because here's whose grandson you are. You know, and my parents were very open-minded, educated individuals who knew there was no difference between good people, right? So it wasn't like, hey, this is the American way or this is the Afghan way. It's like, no, this is the human way.
Yeah.
When we speak culture, we're talking about in-home culture, like language, like etiquette, like values, like understanding the DNA running through you. And it was, you know, again, that's where the battle of belonging came in, because I spent the majority of my life up until my adulthood never considering America home, because you'd always hear like, when we go back, like when it opens up, we're going to go back and you'll see how we lived. Because growing up in the United States, you know, it's funny, so many people will look at me and talk and read the book or read my interviews and always be like, man, you've had so much trauma growing up. And it's funny that when you grow up in a situation where you don't know anything else, it was far from trauma.
Yeah.
I can tell you, I probably lived the best childhood I know. I knew of anybody. That's what I believed until I got older. But again, the battle was primarily like I never knew this was home, because at any minute we thought we were going back. Back to home. And I think I was 17 years old or so when it finally hit me that this is home and I need to belong. And what do I do to belong? And I really didn't believe that, you know, I had any access to any sort of freedom of feeling I belong without sport and physical activity. And I've always been extremely obsessed with athletics, but I never knew why until I was 17. Where I realized how much sport was doing in regards to allowing me the opportunity to recognize my value and belonging.
Yeah.
And it was literally the power of football that, you know, this Afghan refugee, you know, kids coming up being like, yo, I want to be an outside linebacker, defensive end. And, you know, I know what it takes to get there. And my freshman year in high school, actually, I was one of those guys that played in the fifth quarter.
Yep.
I don't know if those
like
exist
the like the
here.
JV game kind of at the end of the game.
Yeah,
or whatever.
Where you give like the special guys 35 plays to kind of just here. You feel like you're on the team. Go get a stick mark.
Yep.
So, you know, soccer kind of was my thing growing up. And it was actually soccer that kind of got me interested in football, because there was an opportunity to kick.
Oh, yeah.
And I would just kick the ball like you couldn't believe as a freshman. And that really kind of helped elevate the brand a little bit. Like, wait a second. But I just like everything else in my life since then, I'm like, well, let me do something to get the door open and I can prove I have more to offer.
Well, I think a lot of people don't understand this too, which is, and I don't know the exact dates, but from my understanding, just like from the little bit of history I know about it, Afghanistan used to be a pretty open place. It used to be like a pretty, I guess like safe place. I don't know how the best way to put it, but I mean, it wasn't like maybe the US, but it was pretty open, but that changed. So from your childhood, was it still pretty open, pretty relatively safe? And then did that change or how did that work with, with kind of you and your family and moving and everything?
So again, I was born in Germany and came from Germany.
Okay, so you were born in Germany.
So the only access I ever had to Afghanistan was their stories.
Okay.
Until 2004, I actually moved there.
Okay.
And I went back there for about 4.5 years.
Right in the middle of it then.
Right in the middle of this stuff.
Yeah.
Right? But back then, I mean, if you look at my parents' wedding photos, I mean, it was night and day from what you see. I mean, people in dresses and skirts and suits. No one ever left their home in the city without a suit on.
Wow.
You see? Music, language, art, poetry, you know, the outdoorsmanship, like the hunting community. My paternal grandfather had a massive logging business from the Kunar and Nuristan Mountains.
That's crazy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So they were very, very sophisticated. You know, my grandfather, who's a general, is a jet fighter. Imagine the intellect and the education that comes into operating Bagram Air Force Base. Like, it was a completely different level of education, etiquette, humanity. And in 79, my man, like, it all froze. Yep. Education froze, governance froze, faith froze, you see, but Afghanistan still claims itself as an Islamic republic and an Islamic emirate. Look, I've had the privilege of being able to read and study as best I possibly can with the limited knowledge I have of every faith. And every faith and its every Abrahamic faith in its original form is the exact same. Mm-hmm. It's simply about the purification of the heart. And when these types of things freeze, like it did in Afghanistan, then you get what you get today. But Afghanistan was night and day from where it's at now and where it was. We've gone back maybe 200 years, because of the freeze in society and growth.
I had seen, and this is like a couple of months ago, because I honestly I didn't know anything about it, but it was pictures from like the '50s or something, and it was like it could have been in Afghanistan or in the U.S. Like it looked like the same kind of, I don't know, like almost like capitalism or whatever you want to call it, right? But it was normal. And now the pictures you see there is completely different, or the videos and stuff. And you never know what's really going on, right, with the media and everything else. But it just seemed like, man, it seemed like the '50s, they were further advanced societally and maybe with the openness of it than they are now. And it's wild to see how that can change. And it's not that long ago, right? Like it's not that long ago,
right?
And it's changed so much. Like, what are are your parents still alive?
My father passed. Not long ago, and a majority of my insight and breakthrough of what's shared in that book actually came from his decline and actually his last breath.
Wow.
And my mother is here. Yeah, my mother's alive and strong.
What did they say about it? Is it just heartbreaking to them? Is it?
So one of my dear, dear friends, one of my best friends, who you know, Brian Callen, was recently visiting us for a week. And I remember at breakfast, he sat there and he looked at my mom. He goes, "Mama Azeem, what do you miss about Afghanistan?" And she just tilted her head to the right and said, "Everything."
Yeah.
Right. But she also moved back in 2003 to 2011 to establish the first, you know, women's education initiative in the eastern regions of Afghanistan in Tora Bora.
Oh, wow.
To prove that Afghanistan was ready for change.
Yep.
And it was her promise to her father before he had gotten taken by the communist. And, you know, it's that is what she missed. And when she went back, like, of course she loves the dirt, the smell, the kids, the innocence, but it there's a majority of the Afghan population from my family who don't want to go back because they don't want to look at Afghanistan any different than what they had it because of what it's turned into today. And again, what it's turned into today is that's the outcome of war. It's the outcome of greed. It's the outcome of corruption, self-interest. You know, that's what caused the demise of this country in the first place. Like everything was going just fine, but the ego, and the penetration of sources who needed Afghanistan to be unstable won, right? People want Afghanistan to be unstable in that region. It's why it's never been conquered.
Yeah.
You know, from Genghis Khan to Alexander the Great, to the British, to the Soviets, the collapse of communism happened because of Afghanistan, to what's recently happened, right? Like, it just can't be conquered, and it's not designed to be conquered, right? If you let Afghanistan be what it's capable of being, it'd be that rain you keep alluding to of, man, in the 50s and 60s, it was just completely different. Like, yeah, because it was left alone.
Yeah. So I'm curious, like, what it would look like, because obviously there's so much more I want to get into, but I am kind of fascinated just how a culture can go from seemingly thriving to pretty rough to be in a very short period of time. Do you, do you ever, like, when you went back, I guess, maybe, did it surprise you, maybe the way that people think now versus maybe what your parents had told you about?
Yeah, it's a great question. I actually experienced, just on etiquette alone, on my flight from, the first time I ever went back was a very, very random, the first time I went was a very random emotional approach into Afghanistan. It was 2004. And I just wrapped up my career at Fresno State as a linebacker there. Now, then I moved to fullback. But I just graduated on May 24th and May 26th. I was on an airplane to Afghanistan.
Wow.
And I went there because of a big family issue with land disputes, and how my father was a very non-confrontational sweetheart, but he was very easy to take advantage of and manipulate because he was in denial of who it was that was actually doing this. Mm-hmm. And obviously, just like every, you know, big land family folks, family, right? And it was heartbroken. So I ended up jumping on a plane saying, like, I'm not going to let this man sit there by himself. I'm his oldest son. And I actually went there for these land disputes. And as I got to the country, I was mentally preparing myself of, look, I'm going to have to do things I probably would have never been okay doing, because you just have to defend yourself in a society like that. Yeah. Things over there are okay that aren't okay here, right?
Like what? I'm just curious.
Well, just, you know, a death, you know.
You got to take somebody killing, out. You take, you know, somebody out. Like
there's the types of fighting. It's immorality. It's a completely different breed of humanity there now compared to what it was when my parents were there.
Yeah.
There was conversations before, and now people don't have the intellect to communicate. The only thing they know how to do is fight. Why? You got 40 years of a frozen country with no economy, no education, no faith, no governance. And you have four generations of savages that have grown up their entire lives just killing and just, you know, overpowering and abusing and doing all these things that are applauded. Like, you succeed when you do that there. And that's what I had to mentally prepare myself of, being okay. Like, this is what's normal here. And I got the first taste of that actually just on the flight from Dubai to Kabul, when I sat on the airplane and I had this older woman next to me as we're entering. And, you know, over here, we're raised on, like, ladies first, mm-hmm. like, especially an older woman. And instead of forming a single file line, it was like cattle of like 50, 60 dudes pushing through this door. And it's like this old woman's got her arm hooked onto mine. And I'm like, simply, like, just the basic etiquette of, like, move out of the way, stand in a single file line, let's get on this thing.
Yeah.
So then my mind's already going, because I'm just a little irritated and pissed. I'm like, who does that?
Yeah.
2 minutes later, we're sitting on the flight. Flight takes off. These guys take their shoes off, and they have their feet on the seat. And they have chaw in their mouth. And they spit on the floor of the airplane.
Wow.
And again, my mind is just like, you've got to be kidding me, right? Because obviously for me, it's like I grew up in a society where, like, there's a little bit of etiquette. You know, there's respect for the person next to you. There's all these things that you learn in elementary school. So what I realized is that when people talk about education in Afghanistan, or when I speak of it, it isn't necessarily about history and science and mathematics. It's about basic human etiquette.
Yeah,
is what we need to educate. And that's the first thing that got attacked when this communist movement came into Afghanistan, is that they destabilized etiquette and morality and humanity. And I mean, I see that happening.
That was going to be my question. I'm like, well, if that's the first step, I'm pretty sure we're well on our way.
Yeah. Yeah. And I'm not, like, you know, I'm not even just here, but generally I just don't have these, like, political conversations, but behaviorally I'm obsessed with, like, just studying behavior.
Yeah.
I see that happening big time here. And it's funny because, you know, people go, why are you so convicted to this? It's because I've seen the outcome of this type of behavior. I was like, look at me.
Yeah.
Right. Like, we're a nomadic culture in this country. Like, I've lived in 12 different homes by the time I graduated from high school.
Yep.
Right. Like, I've never been able to have, like, other than Trent, like, and David, like, I've never been able to have a friend or a best friend, because I'm like, I'm not going to see you in a week, because I'm for sure the housing authority is going to move us any minute now. Right. Like, we are the outcome of what happens when you allow these types of things to happen. And it's that, right. It's like you target the etiquette of humanity.
It's almost like it dehumanizes people. Right. And I've thought about that so much in the last couple of years. And I don't even know maybe it's political, maybe it's not, but you see some of these protests and riots and stuff, and some of the stuff that people are doing to each other during that. And it's like, how could you possibly think that's okay?
Well, there's an easy answer to that.
Yeah.
It's the easiest way, without bleeding or sweating or earning, to belong to something.
Yeah.
you're a lifelong athlete. You're a football player. You're a football coach.
Yep.
Like, look what you go through in order to get your boys to realize, like, I need to be on this team, and here's what I need to do to be on this. More than anything, right? Without the not even thinking about the W's or the championships or any of that, it's about what your responsibility is of the person next to you. Like, what do you got to do to protect, to create that hole for that running back to run through? What do you got to do to protect that quarterback to get that ball into the end zone? Like, everyone has to work in order to earn their value on the team. These types of these types of movements and these types of situations are going on. They're very easy ways of belonging to something without actually being responsible for doing anything, right? Other than what? Just causing separation and hate and anger, which is very easy to do. Right, it's a lot harder to have a relationship with somebody by respecting them and asking how they are and telling them you love them and giving them a high five and helping them push up a mountain if they're exhausted or tired. Or, you know, there's this thing you got to, there's work involved in respect. But it's very easy to just walk down the street, flip someone off and cuss them out.
Yeah.
Right? And then just have an enemy.
Yeah.
And cause divisiveness. But if that's applauded and that gives you an opportunity to belong to something, 9 out of 10 times people are going to choose that. Hence why I'm seeing a bit of a demise in some of our communities and cities here, which is heartbreaking.
Yeah. How much of a change have you just seen? Because I would imagine you're probably pretty hypersensitive to that, right? Like, I would think just from a cultural standpoint, even from when, like, you remember as a kid to what it looks like now, have you noticed like a huge shift in the way that people treat each other and kind of just the humanity, I guess, even?
Well, look, we're also getting older now, right? We're more aware of things now than we were when we were kids, right? Yep. We're all in our late 30s, mid to late 30s now, early 40s. These things must have existed before, but, you know, we were busy playing football. We were busy, you know, running around with our friends. We kind of didn't look into these things. But the older we're getting, now we have families, we're mindful of these things that have always existed. I mean, obviously, we're all very well read. And understand history. Like, this is a very common, consistent thing. I just don't want our friends in the U.S. to freak out about what's happening right now, because we are a very young country here.
Yep.
And if we read and understand global history, this is something that happens consistently in order to evolve and get better. But heck yeah, I see it and I'm happy. Why? Because it's an opportunity for us to get stronger. It's an opportunity for us to unite. It's an opportunity for us to create more inclusion of individuals who can kind of contribute, you know, allowing other people to have a seat at the table versus a very particular, you know, group and community only. And I'm not talking about, only white people. I'm talking these parties, right? Like these, you've got this, like, if you're not a part of this group and you're not one of us, then you're the enemy to the world. And it's like, no. Like, but the thing is, unfortunately, you kind of let these things happen in order for everybody to understand the value of unity and respect. So hell yeah, I've seen a massive change, right? Like, because again, one, I wasn't aware. Two, the times are a lot different now. Why? There's a lot more access to things that you and I never knew about growing up because social media didn't exist back then.
Yeah.
Right? There's a lot of things that we just never really knew about unless you were in.
Yeah.
But now everything is exposed and everybody has an opportunity and a voice.
Do you think that's healthy? I worry. I worry that's not healthy to know. Like, you know what I mean? Like, I feel like when before social media, you kind of knew what was going around in your area, maybe your community or whatever. And now it's like you hear, and the media drives obviously the bad stuff, right? Because it creates reaction in us. And I think most of us know the game, but like hearing about stuff in other parts of the country, sometimes it's like, man, can I just be in a little isolated bubble and just have a good life here?
Yeah. No, I think it's, I definitely think it's extremely healthy for those who want to be responsible.
Yeah.
You know, my cousin Ryan and I talk about this on every single hunt and every single road trip because we've got hours together. And we always wonder, like, how could you not want to solve something?
Right.
And what we come to realize is that, look, a lot of individuals avoid admitting to being aware of what's going on because there's a responsibility associated with being aware.
Oh, yeah.
It's kind of what I was alluding to in the earlier conversation where I said, I want to save this for your podcast, which is that. It's the fact that there's a responsibility that's associated with acknowledging there's an issue, right? So it's better to either avoid, you know, recognizing the issue, or if this issue is going on, what can I do to kind of avoid participation on the responsibility side? Well, boom, I'll jump over to the other side and just add more fuel to the fire and just keep this thing unstable because at least I'm doing my part.
Yeah. Yeah. I know for me, sometimes I have that issue. Is you see something or somebody, like, I just want to help you. But then, like, sometimes it's like, maybe they don't want help. Maybe they don't, they're good with where they're at. Do you ever struggle with that? Just kind of seeing
look
that?
What I do for a living.
Yeah.
Right. What I do for a living is kind of jump in on pushing on this optimization and maximization of self capability. And I do this because I'm a very selfish person. Right. I do this because I need that.
Yeah.
Like, I need this more than anybody I know. Like, I need to be held accountable. I need to be able to embrace this discomfort with fear that I have. And I also have no problem admitting to the fact that I'm probably one of the most insecure people you ever meet in your life. But I'm okay acknowledging it because I also want the responsibility of building a relationship with it and utilizing it.
How do you actually come to that? Because I know, you know, so many of us with insecurities and stuff, it's almost like we, you know, you hear the fake it till you make it. I might be insecure, but I could fit, like, I mean, it takes a lot of self-awareness to actually admit that. Like, how did you, like, even just the mindset of having the awareness to know, like, hey, I have insecurities and I'm okay with it. Like, I'll tell everybody on a podcast I have insecurities. Like, most people are like, no, I'm a big, tough guy. Like, you can't rattle me. Like, why are you so open about it?
What's tougher than admitting to it?
Hiding it. Lying about it.
So what's tougher, right? You're a tougher, big, bad dude if you could admit to it. So where does that put you? It puts you versus the person across from you.
Yeah, very true.
Right? So one, I just want to be tougher. I want to be stronger. I want to be bigger. I want to be able to be one that's never questioned about intention. So therefore, I need to do what's not normal, right? Because normal is unfortunately in this day and age, normal is faking it till you make it, right? It's about optics. It's about what can you show on your Instagram versus like who you are. And you know, I think the awareness really comes from my relationship with faith. Because I've also decided that I'm going to not allow humanity to have their finger on the trigger of my faith and destiny. Why? There's something much bigger than you, called God. Okay. And it's the only person I'm answering to. It's the only person I feel. It's the only voice of reason. It's the only thing I can't wait to meet. And at the end of the day, when, you know, I've been building these like internal case studies for the last, you know, 16, 17 years around really trying to acknowledge what is it that's preventing human optimization? Like, what is it that's preventing human contentment? And every single case study I've done has come to the conclusion that it's the fear of the unknown. And it's the disease of fear that's preventing human beings from contentment. And it's interesting that every time I just kind of ask these questions and have these conversations, it always leads to the unknown. And I ask, like, I'll ask you, what is the ultimate unknown? What's the worst thing that could happen?
Ultimate unknown. Yeah. Death, maybe?
Thank you. Anyone who says that, like, I know I got an in now. Why? Because the reality is that death isn't an unknown. It's actually the only guarantee.
Very true.
So I think now that I'm in your teammate here, it's going to be very important that I hold you accountable to the most important thing, which is preparation for death. And why I talk about preparation for death isn't about organizing your funeral or your will or any of this. It's being mindful of what it is you're taking to death, right? When you die, out of everything you have in this world and everything you've done in this world, what is it you're taking to your grave?
Nothing.
A feeling.
Yeah.
Actually, it's an accumulation of everything, right? And if feeling is the only thing we're taking to our grave, then that's the only thing I want to hold you accountable to every single day. Does this contribute to how you want to feel on that last breath? Right? And I think that when you get to that state of actually realizing that death is a guarantee, death is real, death is the only thing we should prepare for, then that alone contributes to decisions of everything you make in your life. From how you want to look, to how you, what you want to eat, to who you want to associate with, to most important, obviously, precious asset in the universe, time, where you want to delegate this, how do you want to treat yourself, you know, this like, I'm done, man. Like, I'm done not being honest. I'm done being a circus monkey. I spent so much of my life, and I'm young still, obviously, I'm 39, but I still spent so much of my energy in my life trying to create these optics so people never knew I was raised on Section 8 and food stamps and housing. You know, there were times where my father, God bless his soul, we'd be at the grocery store. Back then, it used to be called Food for Last. Today, it's called Food Max. We'd be standing in line, and he'd stare over at me. He goes, hey,
yeah,
I'm about to pay with funny money. Oh, And that was a signal, like, run outside, go to the car just in case any of your classmates are around, because I know you're embarrassed of this.
Yeah.
Look at today, 39 years old, like, I'm grateful I was able to go have all that and to be able to talk about it, something that actually fed my family, protected us, gave us an opportunity to be able to contribute to being a part of this American opportunity and be able to be something for this country. All came by way of the things I used to have shame from. Why? Because of the fear of being judged. And I just got to a point in my life where I said, man, I need to just stop allowing the world to have their finger on the trigger of any of my decisions, because I'm going to limit myself and be normal. This is why you'll see on a lot of stuff that my teammates and I kind of post about or share, there's always a hashtag called not normal. And there's a hashtag called stable of champions. And this isn't necessarily about world titles or Super Bowls, right? It's about that fight internally, winning those fights, right? The fights that you can only feel, right? The championships you can only feel, which is, again, I feel like I'm a champion because I finally embrace my insecurities. I feel like I'm a champion because I have no problem talking about my sensitivity or being vulnerable or, you know.
How'd you get to that point, though? Because I see so many times people get to a point in their life to where they're like, I'm done. I'm done trying to hide my insecurities. I'm done. Like, it's almost like an accumulation of, like, I'm just so tired of all the bullshit, right? Like, I'm tired of lying about stuff. I'm tired of everything else. So I've got to embrace this. Or was it more things that you learned and slowly progressed into that type of a mindset around fear?
No, I think it evolved when I just started seeing the reception amongst a lot of my teammates that I was working with. So a lot of the folks I had the privilege of kind of being able to coach and work with were individuals that were suffering from addiction, depression, anxiety, PTSD, suicidal thoughts. And why I was so attracted to this is because I was raised in a home with a lot of that. You know, when you kind of grow up spending a majority of your youth break time, whether it be your summers or your weekends, in psych wards and insane asylums, because my parents were both diagnosed with a lot of mental deficiencies. And I never understood why, because they weren't crazy. But like anyone with a mental health disorder or depression or bipolar or schizophrenia or all these chemical imbalances, you'd grow up always be looking at these things or they'd be defined as crazy versus just someone who's just emotionally and mentally unstable. Mm-hmm. Trauma's real. You know, like my mom was the daughter of the most decorated general in the history of the country. She was the only daughter and the first child with four brothers. Of course, she's going to have a lot of trauma seeing her father taken away alive by the communists and executed. Of course, they're going to have the trauma of seeing people as they're leaving the country, their brains getting blown out. And, you know, same thing with my father and so on. But when they come into this country, they also have this issue with communication barriers. Yeah. They can't speak and express at the capacity a psychotherapist or a psychologist or a counselor could understand. So immediately there's these diagnoses on like, oh, he can't talk. He must be super depressed. So my point is a majority of my father's life, of me growing up around my father and my mother, and the older I got, I realized that my parents were misdiagnosed. And that led to my father taking 30 to 40 different types of pills a day. It you'll read this in the book. Like, you know, I was in third grade when I came home with a whole bunch of figs in my shirt because it was my father's favorite thing with my cousin Sal. And I'm like, dad. And I come into the house. He's not answering. I go up into his bedroom and he's sitting Indian style facing a wall. And I'm like touching his face and it's just getting harder and harder and harder. And he had a freak out. And I was in third grade where I didn't know what to do. And I'm screaming and calling and 911 and family and so on, and my father gets taken out in a straitjacket. Third grade, you know, wow. Staring at this thing, and I'm like, but my dad's not crazy. Like, why is he in a straitjacket? You know, and then 2 days later, we go visit him at this insane asylum in Richmond, and people are like picking at him. Like, these guys who just kind of love him. They're all obviously pretty, actually really mentally ish. And it's my sister, my older sister, my younger brother, Yosef, my mom and I, and you could see my mom is just shattered and my dad's just so embarrassed. And I'm just like, I think I was the one who was the most aware of like what was going on. I'm like, you know, and I just kind of, at that point, my mind started going, I'm like, but my parents aren't sick. Right. They're just not understood.
Yeah.
So I've just been obsessed my entire life. If you just read my story and you kind of look at some of the folks I've been working with, it's strictly about bringing in understanding to people. That's it. I'm not no therapist. I'm not no psychologist. None of that stuff. But I'm just, I think I have an ability by just having this understanding that folks just aren't understood. And it's important to give these individuals the benefit of the doubt. And if you look at my stable, it's everybody that's kind of been turned and pushed out of the league or, you know, other communities like the black sheep, like, oh, no one can work with them. No one can, you know, get these guys back. And why I've had such a high success rate is because I've just gotten them to a state of not being understood by anybody but themselves. And that's kind of what went with my father. When you ask, like, how'd you get to this thing, was just always being obsessed with wanting to know how I can help understand myself. Right? Or why do I feel like this? And it was by understanding other people and like kind of like deflecting what I was doing for people actually from myself. And in 2014, my father got very ill and he had this brain disease, which is very, very rare, called supranuclear palsy. And very rare. And well over, I think, only just about 200,000 cases of this, so they have nothing for it. It's like ALS. Like, they just don't have anything for it. And he just deteriorated like fast. And I was like, man, long story short, you know, he still was in a really decent mental state. And we had a conversation one time. We had this little episode and like just a health episode. And we got him out of the hospital and we're standing in the Walgreens parking lot. And I just parked the car and I actually did a game plan with my dad. And game plan is kind of my method of it's just a rebrand of something called an honest conversation. And I had an honest conversation with my dad and he's like, son, I don't fully understand what it is you do, you know, and I love the fact that you built Empower. And he's like, it's just interesting to me that so many people are coming to you with problems, but you're using sport to actually like dive into these things. Why? And I said, well, Dad, like sport and physical activity are actually the most correlative like thing you can ever imagine to mental and emotional health deficiencies. He said, how? I said, physically, you're capable of doing X, Y, and Z. But even in that physical process, there is a mental trigger that gets you to that. But why do we stop that when it comes to our emotions and to our feelings? Why don't we push trying to understand insecurities? Why don't we push trying to understand vulnerabilities? But when it comes to physical, you do it all day long. Like you're shaking on some push-ups and I yell like two more. You do it.
Yeah.
But you never feel that bad if you do that mentally. And you're already showing yourself physically like, you're getting shaky, you're getting nauseous. Like, which thought ever makes you shaky and nauseous? It doesn't. But you could do it physically. That means you could. So he was just like, oh my God, this is fantastic. And I said, what about you? And he just stared at me. And we had this really awesome game plan. And my dad really started telling me, like, I can't believe this. You're totally right. Like, he's like, I've never been sick. He said, if you were around 30 years ago, he said, I would have never been in the state that I'm in. I said, what is that? He said, I'm drowning in fear. He's like, I haven't been able to communicate that for 30 years. I'm drowning in fear. I'm like, the fear of what? Of losing things, right? Like, this is all we have left. And I said, well, Dad, nothing is yours. He goes, what do you mean? I said, none of this goes to your grave. All this land frustration you have, all this X, Y, and Z frustration you have, all of this stuff that you have here, none of it goes to your grave. None of it's yours. And he got so quiet and just stared at me. And was like, oh my God. He said, my mental health disorder has literally been about the fear of losing things. And now it's all I have is you guys, and I'm scared of losing that. And I said, but we're also not yours. We're not going to your grave. And my dad, and that happened very naturally. It was just a conversation that came off the cuff. And that's what made me, actually, I was talking to myself, to my dad, actually, of like, you really have nothing to lose. Nothing really is yours. Like, even this shirt will has a longer lifeline than I do. It'll probably be here in 70 years and I won't, right? So why take so much of these things that we take personal? And as that happened, my father started to have a decline about 4 or 5 months later. And, you know, January 11th in 2014, he gave his last breath at home. And it was my younger brother, Yosef, and I, my mom, my sister, one of our best friends, Jared, were in the room at, you know, 2:26 in the morning, and my dad literally took his last breath and he dropped his head to the left and he smiled. He literally did this. He's all with a smirk on his face. And I looked at him and I looked at Yosef and I'm like, oh my God. I'm like, what is it? I think dad just went to heaven. He's like, nah, dude, he's smiling. He's just resting. I'm like, "No, I really think he just took his last breath." And my mom puts a mirror in front of his nose. And my mom's like, "No, your dad just went to heaven." So I spent my entire life so protective of this man, where I said I would blow my brains out if anything ever happened to him. To where when he actually took his last breath, I think he saved me.
Wow. What do you mean by that, though?
He made me realize the entire purpose and intention of existence was to die content.
Die with a smile.
It's chapter one of the book.
That's awesome.
Smiling at death.
Yeah.
And the fact that my dad left this world so content made me realize, like, oh my God, the entire purpose and mission of this world, my responsibility now is to make sure that every single human being that ever comes across my life dies content.
How much do you think that conversation with him just a few months before that had to do with that?
I think my dad always had that, you know? But again, my dad wasn't one to speak much. He was very quiet. Mm-hmm. And you'd always wonder, why does he act the way he does? And after he passed, just like I'm sure you experienced with God bless your father, his life, you realize so much of what they were doing that never had to be said when you're ready to understand it.
Right.
There isn't a day where me and my siblings and my cousin Ryan and one of my best friends, Jake, talk and I'm like, I totally understand like why my dad was saying what he was saying or doing what he was thinking or how he's acting around people. He was so ahead of the game.
Yeah.
That I truly do believe, and I told my dad this, like I told Jake, everybody left the bedroom and I grabbed him by his head, it was like 10 minutes before, like right after he had passed, and I said, "Your entire purpose in this world was this moment. Like, you've now sealed the deal on what the Empower concept is, which was die content." And it was that, man. It was that moment in my father's passing that I realized nothing should prevent me from feeling free. Mm-hmm. And it's not about nothing matters. It actually made me realize how everything matters. Right, and if everything matters, then I need to contribute to everything like it's the last thing. Anything I'm associated with,
yeah,
right. And the most important association I have in this world is my relationships with humans. Mm-hmm. You know, and I do think that it's very easy to get. I do think it's very easy to get extremely complacent in a society, especially like this. Because there's running water and there is electricity, that we get pretty complacent with our human responsibility to one another. And I'm really hoping that I have an opportunity to just share this perspective with people. Not that I have the answers by any means, but for me and my teammates and in my stable, this has worked tremendously for us conquering these internal goals. That obviously give the outcomes that you see today. These championships don't get won, and these Super Bowls don't get won, and these organizations don't become what they become without actually having that internal component solved. That's just an outcome, yeah. Right? Like, that's just the outcome. That's not the end all be all. That's just part of the process. And that's how I came to this understanding, was literally that journey of growing up, having the opportunity to be victim and fall victim and never surrendering to it has been what's kind of crafted this perspective, is the fact that I've never decided to take that victim role out, which I could. Mm-hmm. I have some friends and some family who actually leverage the crap out of, like, "Oh, we came here as refugees, you know, our parents had it so hard, and you know, we don't really need to push ourselves. Like, you know, we deserve this." I mean, it's been 35 years. Some of them have been in the United States of America and still on housing in Section 8, you know, because we deserve it. And I'm not judging him, but it was something I always told myself. I never want to look in the mirror and be someone like that I could judge.
Right.
You know? So I said, what do I need to do? Is I just need to be responsible to truth. And truth to me is death. And the feeling I'm taking to my grave is truth. And that's all I invest in.
I've heard stories of people dying kind of not peaceful, right? Like, I've heard stories of this. Do you think, based on maybe what you've seen and studied, that maybe is somebody who isn't dying content?
I mean, my response to that is always, that's between, only God knows.
Yeah.
You know, like, again, you and I both don't know what people are going through and have gone through to be able to create these types of assumptions, especially individuals who have a platform and a stage of influence. Mm-hmm. I stay very, very mindful of if I haven't touched you, hugged you, you know, like if we haven't, you know, shook hands and hugged and been bros and teammates, I don't know. I just don't know.
I'm just curious because I love it, right? Like one of the big things I've talked about on the podcast so often is, you know, going hopefully to my deathbed someday without regrets, without, you know, content, I guess would be the other way of that coin maybe. And like, I remember when my grandma passed away and it was very peaceful and there was family around there and it was kind of similar to what you describe about your dad. And then I've heard other stories of people kind of kicking and screaming their way into it. And I've always just wondered, right? And not to judge anybody, but I guess like when I die, I hope that I'm like ready for it. Then I'm like, I'm good with it.
That's how you have to live.
Yeah. So what do you think maybe if someone's listening and they're like, I want to be able to die with a smile on my face. Like, what are some of the, I don't know, what are maybe some of the principles that you could share with them?
Number one is just cleaning your heart, right? I use this analogy quite a bit. I always put my palm out. I open my hands, right? I open my hands and I look at my entire hand as a plot, a land, real estate. But that's your heart. Mm-hmm. And I go, you see this thing the way it is? It's just crisp and clean right now, right? But I can easily go out in the backyard and put some manure on it and like a bolt and some rusted stuff and kind of look at it and doesn't look as sexy as it did a second ago and it was just clean slate, right? So I also think about what kinds of things are sitting on your heart that equate to like it being a pile of shit on your hand. Mm-hmm. What can you do to remove those things first, right? So number one, clean your own heart versus trying to clean your judgment.
Is that relationships? Is that
everything?
Maybe guilt?
Everything, is that, right? Like, man, I hadn't have an opportunity to, man, I should forgive this person and get that anger off my heart. And remember, a lot of this stuff, you don't need to call people and, hey, I forgive you. Mm-hmm. Clean your heart. In your heart, just forgive, right? If I haven't been able to say thank you to someone, which I should say thank you to, but it just kind of, my ego's getting in the way of me being able to show gratitude because I don't want them to think, you do your part. Clean your heart, right? If I want to appreciate someone or something, and I haven't given them that because I left dangling this carrot in front of them of like, I'm always just going to make them think they need to earn this. Don't surrender to that. Trust the intention behind why you're doing this. And the thing is that just become selfish, right? You purify your heart, you're becoming selfish. With the intention of what? My selfishness is going to lead to selflessness, mm-hmm. right? So I would say the first and only thing I think we need to do in order to find contentment is purify our own hearts, right? Don't make it about optics and actions, right? Don't make it about like making 500 bag lunches and going to the homeless shelter. Oh, I did my job. I'm a good person, right? Because again, you're being judged on your intention,
right?
Right. But how could you want people to do for you what you won't do for you? Accept yourself, forgive yourself, appreciate yourself, right? Give yourself that freedom. And it's so funny how we make self-development and self-maximization so complex when the reality is like you're in control of how you want to feel.
Yeah.
Right? But it's a practice, man. It's no different than like us wanting abs. Like you got to do the sit-ups, you got to do the diet, you got to run, right? Like, oh, I want that elk. Well, go train for a whole year because that's the only way you're going to get it.
Right.
Right? Like there's a practice that's associated with the end game. We can't not think like that when it comes to our feelings. It's a practice.
One of the biggest things I know that helped me is that, and I did an episode about it. This is going back a ways, was forgiving my stepmom after we went through everything. You know, we were talking a little bit about kind of that journey before and just sending her an email and being like, look, there's probably some things that I could have done better in that situation. I forgive you. When I drive by your house, I'll wave at you. Because it got to the point for me, again, like you talk about this selfishly, to where I would drive by her house and see her outside and it's like, I don't know what to do. Do I wave? Do I flip her off? Do I pretend like I don't see her? It was just like this anxiety that it was creating. And it was like, this is bothering me being mad at her basically. And so I was like, screw it. Like maybe she'll respond to the email. Maybe she won't, but it'll be off my heart, you know, talking about exactly what your principle is there. And honestly, like it was the best thing probably I ever could have done. Like we actually kind of have a relationship now.
Yeah.
And, but more importantly than that, selfishly, is that when I drive by, I wave. And I told her that in the email. I was like, when I drive by you, I'm going to wave at you. You can wave at me or you cannot. I don't really care. But I'm going to wave at you, because part of it was like, I got so stinking anxious anytime I would see her outside. And I would drive by her several times a week sometimes, right? And so I was like, I'm going to wave at you. And then she emailed me back and she's like, well, I'll wave at you too then. And that was like, that's what kind of started like at least a little bit of the reconciling. But more importantly though, it was like, I never got that anxious feeling again. And it's almost like silly to admit that, right? Again, like you talked about, but like just real life is that it gave me anxiety. And then I just got to the point, I'm like, this is so stupid.
Mm-hmm.
It's so stupid. I don't hate her, right? Like I don't, like I forgive her, you know, I'm moving on. And then after that, it was like, wow, what a big burden that took off. Like, you know what I mean?
And, of course and, I know
and
what you
yeah.
mean.
And just almost like that vengefulness and that hate in your heart. It's such a heavy burden to carry.
It's easy to hate.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Like, why do we obsess over loves? Like, right? Why when you find a love, like, I have to marry this person, I have to have children, and then how you feel about your kids. Like, is it easy having kids?
No.
No. Look how much you have to do to make sure they eat.
Right.
Look how much you have to make sure they're healthy. Look how much different things go through your head every day. What could happen if they cross the street, God forbid? What could happen if a rock falls? Like, there's so many things that go on with you protecting love. It's work.
Right.
Right? But it's easy to hate. There's no responsibility to hate.
That's so true. That's so true.
So my proposition to my teammates is, if you do that for you, right?
Yeah.
Imagine how you'd feel.
Yeah.
And look at the little doses and tastes you get just from actually working to love yourself, working to love what's important to you. And to you, it's, T, I need to die content. Well, what do we do to clean your heart?
Yeah.
Right? What do we do to clean your heart? And everyone's different. Some folks might be just super heavy with forgiveness of the past, like parent relationship. Some could be the easy out of the battle with addiction. There's a process to that, right? There's the individuals that have cheated their ways into things, and just like this guilt is like, I don't, you know, like, yes, I've made billions of dollars and it's not fixing anything. I'm actually getting worse.
Yeah.
You see? So, I mean, everybody has an internal war. And in Islam, they actually call this internal war jihad. That's what jihad means. It's the fight within, you see? Mm-hmm. And it's that. Like, that's what I always refer to, as I said earlier, right? Like, that's the championship to win, right? It's, if you could win that war within, there's what would you lose?
Yeah.
Yeah.
You have nothing to lose, right?
Yeah. So I think we just make existence very, very complicated, because it's easy to be complicated.
Right.
It's very difficult to be simple. But you got to just be a hungry, determined, you know, blood hungry, sweat hungry beast in order to be simple.
Yeah.
And look how, like, you, your story, Ryan's story, my story, like, we have the blessings of having access to as much that you want to consume in this world as you possibly can, from like jobs and economics and big city living and Costco's and all of this. But the older we're getting and the more we're realizing that, like, success actually means simplicity. We're all kind of like getting into this like rural life of like, you know, no, I got to like harvest my own food. I've, you know, I don't need much. I just need to have my five friends and, you know, and it's just funny. Like, if you think about it, like, the circle of life we're all going in is that we actually came into this world thinking we need to do and have, to like realizing towards this end part of our lives that, like, no, it needs to just come back to oneness. Mm-hmm. That's what you're coming back to right now. Like, you went from depending on, you know, the job and the tech company and the money and the massive house in the city and like the bars and the restaurants are all there and so on and the ski resorts here, right? Like all
yeah.
of us.
Oh yeah.
And then you kind of start to grow up a little bit and realize, like, wait, actually that's easy. The hard part is actually saying the word no, right? To these desires, right? And then actually creating new desires, that the struggle is a little bit more real, that actually fulfills the feeling you want when you pass, right? Because at the end of the day, right, like, death is literally designed to save us. Like, we're all terrified of death, but death only happens when it's saving you from pain.
Wow. Man, this has been fun. We're going to have to do it again.
Thank you for having me.
We're going to have to do it again. So I've got to ask you, though, we're wrapping up here, and this is just such good stuff. I hope you guys get his book. All right, so In the podcast, I always like to cover kind of three main pillars: liberation, mindset, hopefully helping people think about things from a different perspective; lifestyle, you know, hoping hoping people can kind of design, just exactly what you're just talking about, design a lifestyle that you want to live. And then lastly is legacy. So one of these days, obviously, I know you've worked with some of the top athletes in the world. You've done some insane things, like going back and helping with different sports organizations. And I mean, guys, like, check out Tarik. He's got all kinds of crazy stuff that he's done, the awesome stuff. But there will come a day maybe where you're looking back, or maybe it is even after you're gone. The third pillar is legacy. Like, what do you want your legacy to be when it is time for you to hopefully die very contently with a smile on your face?
I'm hoping to surround myself with a ton of people like yourself and others out here, honestly. It's kind of why I'm here. My dream, my entire life, the older I've gotten, has always been to be able to form some sort of relevance for Afghanistan and the world outside of what the media sees Afghanistan as. Mm-hmm. And Ryan, my cousin, has been extremely helpful with teaching me about the outdoors on a very practical level. He's been my hunting coach for the last 10 years, 8 years, teaching me everything I need to know about gear, about all of this stuff. But it's also the fact that I have this teammate in him that's kind of made it safe for me to kind of make this transition into trying to be around this area. And it's because of the intentions been out, I've been aligned with some of the most amazing conservationists I can ever imagine, with a lot of individuals that understand the land, respecting the land, utilization of the land. Mm-hmm. The legacy I'd love to leave behind is, before my time is up, I'd love to be the first to ever build the national park systems in Afghanistan and make Afghanistan the outdoors heaven for the world.
That's awesome. That is so cool.
Yeah, because it's an absolute goldmine for outdoorsmen.
And well, it's similar to here, right?
That's why I'm here. It's identical to here, actually. Yeah. I'm from Kunar, and the topography, everything about this here, mm-hmm, is identical to where I'm from. It's why my mentor, Tom Cable, had suggested, if you're going to do anything in America, you need to look in the McCall New Meadows area, because I'd always show him things about Afghanistan.
The old University of Idaho head football coach,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
I met with him when I was in high school.
Okay.
He was there.
Okay, yeah. He's at the Raiders now.
Yep.
But we met when he was the head coach of the Raiders, and he's the one that gave me my shot, made me relevant in the National Football League as a development guy.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So I was 25 years old, 24 years old, and he gave me a shot with him. Thanks to him, the Marshawns, the Justin Tucks, the Deion Jordans, the Spencer Wares, I mean, the whole stable came to me because Tom Cable gave me my first shot.
Wow.
And he's the one that acknowledged my ideals and my goals. I've told him this years ago, that this is what I wanted to do in some capacity or form. I didn't know what it is I wanted to do, but the older I've gotten, I realized my calling is about building the national park systems in Afghanistan.
How cool.
Yeah.
How cool. Well, we'll have to do it again. I know we're at the end of our time today. You guys got a lot of more important stuff to do, like going out and getting yourself an elk. So I know we got to get out of here. But again, make sure, guys, that you check out the book. Again, it's called Empower, Conquering the Disease of Fear. Just in terms of finding you, where can people follow you? They want to see more about your story.
I have an Instagram only, and okay, it's at Tarik, T-A-R-E-Q.
Okay.
So that's kind of what I have for the social media side. And
book is on Amazon.
The book's on everywhere. Amazon. It's in Barnes & Noble's. It's all over the place. Simon & Schuster
book. Guys, if you don't know, that's where you want to be, right?
It was a massive blessing. And one last little funny story I want to share with you on how I knew this was meant to be. My father passed 7 years ago, and we had this big marketing meeting with Simon & Schuster not long ago about, here's what your media stuff looks like, your obligations, here's what we're going to do with X, Y, and Z, here's where the galleys are going, here are the blurbs, and so on, so on, so on. I said, great, thank you for all this, but when's the release of the book? And they go, well, T, kind of going through the book and the language in the book, not that we're calling it a self-help book by any means, but it's a good motivating book for like New Year's resolutions. So we want to release this book in the new year. I said, okay, fantastic. What's the date? Well, Simon & Schuster only releases books on Tuesdays. And the first Tuesday the book release falls on is January 11th. And I'm not a very emotional dude, but like tears just started trickling down my eyes and I had the massive goosebumps. January 11th is the day my dad went to heaven.
Oh, wow. Wow.
I know this book was meant to be.
Yeah. Wow.
So January 11th.
Yes. You got to get out there and get it, right? Got to get out there and get it. What a fascinating story. Like I said, we could sit here and do this for 3 hours. Ryan's like, man, we're ready to go hunting, so let's get out of here. but no, I appreciate it again, man. It was awesome conversation.
Thank you, brother. Thank you and your family, man. It's awesome to be here.
Yep. All right, everybody. Make sure to get out there, get the book. Hit up Tarek on social media, Instagram, at T-A-R-E-Q. Check him out there as well. And I know you guys are gonna love following along, love his story. And reach out, tell him hello. All right, everybody. We'll talk to you next week. Have a good one.
I absolutely love having you as a listener of the Primal King podcast. If you don't want to miss out on the great content, then it's time to hit that subscribe button right now. Do not be left behind. And then share your thoughts and feedback with a written review of the show. I read every single one of these, and it helps me make sure I am serving you best. It also allows others to find this content, and it builds this community. Make it an awesome day, and we'll see you next time.